So, okay, of course, everybody knows that the human genome sequence was published recently, and we have the Book of Man. But what's the big deal? We have the Book of Worm and Fly several years ago. The question is that with all these books, what are you going to do with them? Right? How do you read them? In the past, the decoding genomic sequence focused on mostly on gene discovery, right? Trying to figure out where are the genes and what kind of protein product they make, and this part to try to figure out the function of proteins. But what about non-coding regions? We now know that, according to the newly published data, about 99% of human genome are non-coding. And what does it do? Mostly we don't know. I guess still largely a mystery. But one thing we know for sure is that the non-coding sequences play an important role in regulating gene expression. So it has regulatory functions that are very important for understanding the developmental process, understanding cellular response to environment, etc. So I would say that by just figuring out all the gene product here in the genome, it's only one part of the story, because it doesn't tell you how the cell work as a whole, how proteins interact with each other, protein interact with DNA, how information is processed. We know that in every step of this gene expression, like from genes to mRNA to protein, this transcription, translation, each of these steps are regulated in a very orderly way. And the regulators themselves are proteins. So for example, a major mechanism to regulate gene expression is to regulate the transcription of these genes. So there are lots of proteins in the cell that are transcription factors, which can regulate the transcription level of many other genes in the cell.
Well, what is known about the distribution of direction for the genes on the genome? Are there genes that are simultaneously encoded for one thing going this way and then the overlap going that way?
Overlapping.
They can be overlapping.
On two strands.
Mm-hmm. Are they sort of randomly distributed on two strands?
I don't know the precise quantitation of that. You see more in compact genome, like in coli and yeast, occasionally yeast. So my remembrance is that about 10% of genes have an overlapping coding open reading frame. You see it very rarely in larger genome. Okay, so if we consider this,
having defined it one time.
Okay, so if we just consider the transcriptional regulation, where proteins, transcription factors can regulate the expression of other genes, including themselves, we are looking at a pretty complicated regulatory network. Just this transcriptional regulation. I'm not talking about regulation on splicing, alternative splicing, translation, or post-translational modifications. So this is a textbook picture of how transcriptional regulation works. There is this machine called polymerase that transcribes the gene. The polymerase needs help from a whole bunch of cofactors, hundreds of them, I guess. Proteins to correctly locate the transcriptional start and start transcription.
Hundreds at a time?
The whole machine, there are transcription factors, TF2, ABCDE, and each one of them will have many, many different components. The pattern binding protein is one of these components.
And they cluster together to make some suite.
Big blob here that binds to DNA. But this is quite general, right? To transcribe a gene, I guess in each genome, probably half of the gene have a TATA box that is recognized by TATA box binding protein. But these factors are general factors. to regulate the gene expression specifically, namely, for example, if the cell is starved with amino acid, you probably want to just turn up the gene expression for genes that are responsible for synthesizing amino acid. So you want to do some specific control, and this is achieved by specific regulatory elements in the DNA sequence. And these regulatory elements are recognized by specific transcription factors. These factors bind to the element. They will interact with the transcription machine to either speed up or slow down the process, transcriptional process. So that's the standard picture of how transcription is regulated in a gene-specific way.
And it's about 200 base pairs or so that are upstream of
here?
The gene that are involved?
There is a proximal promoter that is only about a couple of hundred base pairs around the transcription start. But these elements can be pretty far away from transcription start. There are enhancer elements that can be tens of kbs away from transcription start. And they fold backwards, yeah, and interact in switch dimensional space with the transcriptional machine. I guess this is just a mechanistic picture. It's not really a physical picture because so far there's no quantitation of how the interaction of these transcription factors affect the transcriptional rate. It's basically a mechanistic picture. So to show you a real life example, this is a gene in sir urchin studied by Eric Davidson's lab. And he'll, actually Eric Davidson will be here in April. He'll tell us a lot more about regulatory networks. So this gene, this is a graphic representation of the upstream of that gene, about 2 kb upstream. So you see that this is the transcription start and this is that the gene they study. So you see that in the 2 kb upstream region, there are a whole bunch of regulatory modules. And if you just expand one of that, about 200 base pair upstream, this is a blow up of that 200 base pair region. You see there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about a dozen or so binding sites for various transcription factors. And these modules control the expression of this gene differently during different stages of development. So you see that in real life, this thing can get pretty complicated. What is exciting now is that not only we have the complete genome sequences for many, many different organisms, we also have a systematic way to monitor genome-wide gene expression level, especially through the technology of DNA microarray. So we will also have a section on gene expression where several people, the pioneering people on DNA microarray technology, will come here to tell us about how DNA microarray works. Here I just give you a very quick sketch. The idea is that you can put the DNA probe for each gene on a small well on this microchip, a small dot here. So you can print the, for example, the open reading frame of every gene on a small dot here on this microchip. And then you can take the mRNA sample from whatever you're interested in studying and reverse transcribe the mRNA into complementary DNA with the fluorescence label attached to it. And typically you do that, you take two samples, you reverse transcribe them with two different fluorescence labels, like green and red, and then you cross hybridize with this microarray because the cDNA will hybridize with the corresponding gene target. And after you wash it and you look at fluorescence, then you get an idea what's the concentration of mRNA of the corresponding gene.
You work with complementary DNA because the mRNA is unstable on time scales if you want to study it?
I don't know the answer. I don't know why. It's probably. Is that right? So cDNA probably hybridizes better with the corresponding gene target than mRNA.
The matrix technology goes in a strange way, goes from RNA to DNA. So instead of RNA, if you target what's called cRNA, but
So you can ask many technical questions when Dorizzi and Ulung come here to talk about gene microarray. So this is just to show you one example here. This is an experiment done by Ty Brown and Dorizzi, collaborators, and this is the measurement of what happens when you delete one gene from the genome and you look at the change of mRNA level of every gene. So just a comparison of mutant with wild type, and the after sample is labeled with red and before labeled with green. So you do contrast. So you see that you see lots of responses from whole genome. And this red dot means that this gene go up after you do the deletion. Green means goes down, and you see yellow spots. That means it's pretty much the same.
So this is the result of taking extracts from the mutant and the wild type simultaneously applied into the chip, or do two separate experiments?
Simultaneously. You label them with two different fluorescence label, and then hybridize simultaneously to the array. This is a gene deletion code, the deleted gene code TOP1, which is known to be a general repressor in the cell. So once you delete that, you see lots of genes de-repressed.
At what point in the cell cycle is it done?
There, it's not synchronized. So I assume that it's a mixture of different stages of cell cycle.
Time
yeah, time average. It's not synchronized. Okay, so with the complete genome sequences, which presumably code information for how transcription and regulation should be done, and with this large kind of large-scale genome-wide expression data, we really have a very good opportunity to try to understand what is the cell's transcriptional program. So what I would like to do is that I will tell you a few computational approaches, the theoretical methodologies that we use to try to decode the information from regulatory regions. The first approach is statistical analysis and pattern discovery. This week we have motif fest, so several people will come here talk about statistical pattern discovery. So Gary Stormo tomorrow and Junio Friday. And I will describe to you one algorithm that we developed that used to decipher interesting motifs from regulatory regions. And another approach is that you try to quantitatively model gene expression data, because we have this quantitative data here, and it's connected to the sequence features of the corresponding gene. So you can imagine you can do some quantitative modeling of the data and extract interesting sequence features. And there's another approach that is a comparative study. If two species are close, there's a hope that by comparing the regulatory regions of homologous genes, you should be able to identify functional regions that play a regulatory role. And this approach has been demonstrated to be very useful when people do mouse and human comparison. And Nicholas Rogowski will come here next week to talk about, especially about this approach for doing comparative study. So let me first talk about the statistical analysis we have done. The idea is that since you called the genome a book, the question is that what kind of words do you use, right? What's the dictionary for the book? And we developed a statistical algorithm that can delineate words, for example, from a scrambled text, which I will show you in a minute. And this is the probabilistic segmentation model that we developed, and we call it MobiDick. We applied this algorithm to analyze the yeast genome. We found the codon structure, we found regulatory elements that people know before. We also made many new predictions. And we can also use this dictionary to study genes that are regulated in a similar fashion. So to do that, we have a model for how gene regulation works. I've shown you one picture of the sea urchin gene that Eric Davidson's lab study. So the picture we have in mind is that before you do any model, you need to have a picture in your mind. So this is the picture we have. So to tailor a gene's expression to different environmental conditions, you need to have a whole bunch of transcription factor binding site that respond to different conditions. So each gene will have multiple motifs, and these motifs are typically shared by a whole bunch of genes that are functionally related. For example, I mentioned the genes that synthesize the amino acid. So for example, GCN4 motif occur in many genes that are responsible for synthesizing amino acid.
This can be widely separated on the genome.
Yeah, it can be all over the place in the genome.
One motif, one protein?
One motif, one protein, that's current. I mean, it's the current picture. Probably one motif can be recognized by different proteins, and it, the one motif for one protein is also defined in a fuzzy way, right? Because motif can change, and I will discuss that a little bit later. So, for example, this is one example where you see two binding sites. This is a Tata box. This is a cell cycle related control element buried in this sequence.
Called the Tata box because Tata appears somewhere.
Yeah, TA.
Right, but the other underlying portion is also part of the Tata box?
No, this is another, I made it up. This is some other motif that responsible for cell cycle control.
Can you give me an idea, typically how many genes are given to people as well?
In yeast, the order is about 30, 50.
30, 50
genes. That's order of magnitude, but it varies a lot. Sometimes, transcription factor control only a few genes, or sometimes hundreds.
And motifs, as you've shown, typically consist of about all the 1,000 base pairs?
Oh, the motifs, the binding sites. The binding site of transcription factors is typically only like 8, 9, 10 different lengths. Yeah, in yeast. But there are also motifs that dimer, the transcription factor is a dimer that binds to larger region. In coli, you typically see 20 or 30 base pair long, but not much longer. Typically, this is the order, a few base to 20, 30 base pair long. Okay, so we have, for pedagogical reason, we construct this English text here to illustrate the similarity between this problem finding transcription factor binding site and finding words from a scrambled English text. So this text is created from an interesting novel by taking away word separators and inserting lots of junk sequences in between words. So now you see that the message is scrambled, but if you were able to delineate the words from the text, you will see that call me Ishmael some years ago, never mind. Okay. So this is the famous novel, Moby Dick, interesting story about white whale and the very stubborn captain. So now the question is that given this scrambled text, okay, goodbye. How do you delineate words from it? And the problem can be solved, at least approximately, by the following statistic model. This is what we call the probabilistic segmentation plus maximum likelihood.
Before we get into the text that you're interested in is not the entire genome, but simply the promoter region.
Yeah, we are doing analysis on non-coding upstream promoter regions. You certainly can apply the algorithm to a whole genome. And for each genome, if you do that, you predominantly get codons. I will show you one example.
Presumably there are motifs corresponding to alpha helices, beta
helices, which are pretty subtle, right, in some amino acid level. Okay, so this is the probabilistic model we use to model the data. We say basically you can view the sequence as a concatenation of words drawn randomly from a probabilistic dictionary with the number of words in it with associated probability. So this is how we model the data. It's a concatenation of different words with different frequencies. So now once you say this is the model you're going to use, then you ask, given the observed data, this is a typical problem in statistics, the inference problem in statistics. Once you build a statistic model, you ask, can I infer from the observed data the original parameters? what are the words, what are their probabilities. And this can be done by a maximum likelihood approach. The idea is that for given observed sequence, you can ask, what is the odds of observing it, given that it's described by this dictionary? So the way to compute the odds of observing this sequence is that you try various ways, because we don't know where is the word boundary, so this is a part of missing data. We just simply try to sum over all possible missing data, namely all the possible ways this sequence can be generated from this dictionary. For example, this is one way where you can generate this sequence. You can draw each single letter at each step and put them together. This is just one way. Another way of generating this sequence is that you take an A, you take a G, and then you can take a big chunk, a big word, another word. So we have to sum over all these possible segmentations to have the likelihood function. So the likelihood function is defined as sum over all segmentations. For each given segmentation, the weight associated with that is the product of single words in this specific segmentation. So this is what we are very familiar with. It's just a partition function in statistical mechanics.
So there's no correlation built
in? We ignore the correlation between words.
Right, like GC appearing more likely.
Oh, yeah. So,
things like that.
Yeah. Nevertheless, you can put an additional parameter to model that
right. The
model. But for the moment, we ignore it. In biology, sometimes it's important, I think. Sometimes motifs come in pairs. Mm-hmm. And they can be spaced, the spacing between them can be very variable. So this algorithm is not very good at discovering that kind of structure. But you certainly can do a post-processing after you discover each individual word. Then you ask, you calculate the probabilities that occur together, and then you can start to see their interaction.
Right.
But
aren't the conditional probabilities taken care of the fact, like by the fact, if you use all different segmentations?
Excuse me?
You use all different segmentations?
Yes.
So all the conditional probabilities you use the word are taken care of.
Yeah. The you want some word segmentations because you don't know the missing data. You don't know where is the word boundary. And this is typical because in statistics, if you have missing data, that grows with the data size. Right? So there are two types of data you're trying to infer. One is the dictionary, for example, which is an intensive quantity. When your data grow larger and larger, you have a better and better chance to rediscover the dictionary. But you still cannot recover the word boundary uniquely, even if you have infinite amount of data, because your missing data also grow linearly with the system size. Yes.
This particular one, and if you had the same, a different sequence where the team, one of the keys in the A were reversed in order, you would get the same probability.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas if there are correlations, right, then it wouldn't be the same.
Yes, but it also makes
like
it makes difference. Yes. Yeah. Then it's different, yeah. Then it's different.
But Doron's remark raises some very subtle issues of double counting that you have to straighten out. So, for example, in English, you would say I am. You know, that combination occurs a lot together, I am.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, but you may count I am as a separate word, as a two-letter word.
Yes.
So
I understand. So if the short-range correlation is very strong, you may capture it as a single word.
Right.
Like had been occurred many times, you will just capture it as a separate individual word.
That would be okay in a biological context.
Yeah, I think so.
In practice, what's the limit on the size of the word?
The limit of size, we run dictionary currently up to words of the maximum word length is like 14, 15, 16, could be. Yes. 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 So ideally, you want to do a maximum likelihood ratio test, right? If you add one more word and you ask how much it improves the likelihood function and what do you expect by chance? What we do is in a more intuitive way. We ask that when is the point when you start to add words, the statistics for different word description do not improve a lot. So. The idea is that once you have a dictionary, you ask how complete is the dictionary? How well does it describe the current data by counting various substrings of in the sequence? And so that will have a statistic distribution. If you ask that, if you calculate the expected number for a given string and observe the number of given string, and you calculate this score for that string and you make a plot, there will be a distribution, right? So at the point where your dictionary start to describe the data very well, this distribution will approach to a Gaussian.
Would you like to show a few more examples?
Okay, so how do we construct dictionary? The dictionary construction have two steps, two major steps. One is a plating step, where that given the entries in the dictionary, you try to find the probability assignment to each word, which maximizes the likelihood. So this is within the given number of words in the dictionary. This is the fitting step. For example, we can start with a very simple dictionary with all possible oligonucleotide up to certain length. And then you maximize the likelihood function, you get the probability assignment for each word. And the next step is adding new words. You do statistic test on longer words at this step. Basically, you ask, is the current dictionary appropriate description of the data we observe? You test that by counting the strings of different lengths, and you ask that, what do I expect to see based on the previous dictionary, and what do I observe? And then you calculate, is it are there lots of words that are overrepresented in the data set? And if you find the overrepresented words, then we add them into the dictionary. We say, the dictionary is still not complete. We need to add new words to the dictionary. And then we do the maximization step. And we keep iterating this step until the algorithm converges. Okay, so there are some technicality here. We have two different numbers for a given word. One number is that you simply just count how many times this word occurs anywhere in the sequence. So this is the absolute number. And another word, number NW, depend on segmentation, depend on how you segment the data. This is one example. This says winter is the best season to visit here, which is certainly not true. But if you count the number of THE, you see two, right? So this is the psi of THE. Well, in this specific segmentation, which is the correct segmentation, the THE only occur once, and there's another THE occur here, which purely happened by chance. It's made from one piece from this word and one piece from that word. So you can rewrite the partition function with this state variable, NW. And we can do statistical mechanics. You can define the log likelihood function as a free energy. You can also relate the probability to the energy function. And it's very trivial to show that this average NW is conjugate to the W, or to the energy of the W. And it's also very straightforward to derive this equation, called self-consistent equation, which says at a point when you maximum likelihood, PW has to be proportional to NW. Namely, you can at the beginning, you can guess the PW for every word. And you use this set of PW to do segmentation. You calculate the average number of W. That has to be consistent with your guess. This is very typical what we see when we try to maximize any function physical systems. You always very often you end up with the self-consistent equation. You can treat this as a dynamic equation, but with discrete maps. So every step you plug in the theta pw, you calculate this, you get a new theta pw. And when you maximize the likelihood, you reach the fixed point of the iteration of dynamic equation.
And in practice, you only have one fixed point and it's stable?
This is what we found. So we still cannot prove it.
And sort of in the spirit of a mean field theory, I mean, what is neglected? If you have self-consistent solutions, to be self-consistently wrong. So what is
it? Are you saying why we are seeing only one minimum?
No, I'm just asking, in the spirit of mean field theory, it's a critical phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
One might think that there are fluctuations or correlations that are left out. So are those correlations between statistics worse?
Correlations. So within this model, we are solving this problem exactly, right?
Yes.
With self-consistent equation.
Right.
Are you asking what needs to be added to the model?
Yes.
Well, what needs to be added to the model? Why is what Tony mentioned that you may want to consider word-word correlations or sometimes even long-range correlations? For example, in English, you will have grammar that if something happens, then something will happen. And these two words can be way far away from each other.
Right.
So this type of correlation is very hard to be captured in this type of model. If you can discover each individual word, then you may add them afterwards. The problem is that if both of them are very fuzzy and not statistically significant, you may not discover them each individually, then you miss the structure. Or you scramble the words,
yeah.
Not just the spacing. But you still want to keep the word as a unit.
Yeah, I mean, you take the original text.
Yeah.
You know what are the words.
Uh-huh.
But just scramble the sequence.
Okay, so you randomly swap the order of the words. In that case, then it fits perfectly to our model, right? Because that's what we assume. Then we should get the exact solution. Will be slightly different because in the original text, sometimes you can get head bin or IL, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you completely scramble them, you only get this structure. What is different from the usual statistical mechanics problem here is that we don't know the energy function, right? We need to find energy in a self-consistent way. A couple of technicality here, just to show that the knowledge from statistical mechanics can be very useful for solving this kind of problem. This is to show that you can compute the likelihood function in a linear algorithm by using recursion relation. Right? So if I want to compute the likelihood function of this whole sequence, I reduce that to compute the likelihood function of sequences before that. So this is the recursion relation. You can write down ZL, so if this is L, as ZL minus 1 plus probability of C plus ZL minus 2 times the probability of AC, etc. You recursively do that up to the maximum word length. So it's just linear, the algorithm is linear to the total data length and linear to the maximum word size. And you can, similarly, you can define a Green's function to compute the derivative of the likelihood function very effectively. The idea is that, for example, if you want to compute, this is the sequence, and this is the word that you are interested. You want to compute the first derivative of likelihood function with respect to the p of this word. So you can segment that into partition function at left, multiplied by the p of this word, multiplied by partition function at right. And if you take derivative, this is the result. And then you can just define this as a Green's function at a given position 6 of length 6. So you define the whole class of Green's function at a given position with different lengths. And then you can just, every time you just scan the sequence, you see occurrence of ORW, you just add this Green's function contribution to the corresponding register. So again, this calculation of a first order derivative is linear in time, linear in sequence length. So we solve this segmentation model, use the recursive algorithm, or computer scientists will call it dynamic programming. So we compute these numbers linear, you know, time linear to sequence length and maximum word size. And we solve the fixed point equation, not simply by iteration, because what we found is that as you go close to fixed point, the iteration becomes very slow. So every time you iterate, you move a little bit. So we use the Newton's method to solve the fixed point equation. So at the end, we can assign a probability to each word, and we can also assign what we call the quality factor to each word. And the quality factor is defined by the average number n of word w divided by this absolute number. For example, I gave you this example of Kasai is 2, while in a specific segmentation here, n is only 1. This quality factor tells you how definite you see this word. Because if this quality factor is 1, then it says every time you see this word, the only weight that counts is the way that you correctly partition the word out. So almost every time you see the word, you delineate from the background sequence. Or in that case, you don't say it specifically, right?
Right.
You have some probability for each segment, but you don't see a high quality factor because the word boundary can move around.
Right, because the total number of occurrences is always one, right? You never get the total.
Yes, yes. So it's the boundary is fuzzy if you have a repeated sequence. So let me just show you how this algorithm works for the Moby Dick example I showed you before. So at the first step, it's very simple, right? We guess it's just random 26 alphabet. That's our first guess. So with that guess, you quickly get a probability for each letter. It's just a simple counting in the maximum likelihood approach. So now you ask, is this a correct description of the data? To test that, we just count all these dimers in the data set and compare what do we expect to see based on this dictionary. So we see lots of stuff that is overrepresented in the data set. We throw them back into the dictionary, redo the maximization step. So now you see that because the segmentation is mutually exclusive, when you say th, you can either pass that as t plus h or you pass it as th. So there's a computation. The th will take away some probability from t.
So if a dimer is given correctly by your initial estimate of the individual letters, it's not as efficient, there's some tolerance there.
Yeah, there's some tolerance. And we have an objective criterion for how much more is more, right? If you assume the based on the previous dictionary, the distribution of the word is a Poisson. Then you can compute the z-score for each observed word and calculate its probability. And we set that probability to 1 over the number of strings tested. So in the way that we only want an order of 1 false positive when we do this iteration. So this is the second step. After you have this dictionary, then you ask again, is this dictionary complete? You do the similar game, you test the longer string, 3 and 4, and you find lots of 3 and 4 combinations are overrepresented in the data set. You put them back into the dictionary, redo that convergence step. Again, you see th, because after we add the the, it pushes down the probability of th. Because lots of occurrence of th are associated with the, so you tend to put that into the.
Why did you jump to th and not just
the? We are not doing a complete enumeration. When we do DNA sequence, we do complete enumeration. When we do English, what we do is that every step when we test longer string, we take dictionary multiplied by dictionary. So basically, any piece that we captured in that dictionary, we ask that when you do juxtaposition of the words already in the dictionary, what is statistics? So we are not doing exhaustive enumeration of all possible.
Go ahead. Do you ever jump words out of the dictionary? So I can imagine, for instance, that pH is always pH, and a minimal.
If pH is always pH,
then
at the end of pH, the probability of pH will go down to zero.
You never throw it out from the dictionary?
Oh, yeah, if it's very small. What the criterion is that if the probability multiplied by the number of draw, you can compute. Because you know data size, you know average word length, you can compute what's the total number of drawing. And if the probability multiplied by the number of drawing is smaller than one, we throw it away.
And presumably that would happen with Q, because Q is always followed by U.
Q, U, so Q, U.
Q. Eventually, you get Q,
yeah,
U,
Q will go away. Yeah.
Why is it still there after that dictionary?
No, this is only step three, right?
But even after three, I mean, Q should be really
disappear. Q, U, Q, Q should disappear. Is Q always followed by U? Oh, there are other Q, there are words start end with Q, right? Unique.
No.
Oh, Q, Q, U, Q.
What text are you using here?
What?
What text are you using here? Is the winter is the best time to visit Santa Barbara?
No, no, no. This is the Moby Dick.
Oh, this is Moby Dick.
This is
the
Moby Dick.
Book or just one chapter, one page, one sentence.
Can you think of an example where Q is not followed by U?
No.
Okay, in front. I don't know why it's
so this
here.
Is
right?
Moby Dick, the whole book,
oh, this is the Moby Dick. Only the first 10 chapter of the Moby Dick.
First
10 chapter of the Moby Dick. Why it's here? I don't know why. I guess the answer to your question is that the data is not infinite. If data is infinite,
it doesn't have to be infinite.
No, because there's always a finite probability you can still segment it as a, in a different way, right?
Did you limit all possible dimers?
We did not look for all possible dimers.
So you didn't think of looking for QU.
Yeah. So there are.
This was done on Moby Dick, or it was Moby Dick plus random letters.
Moby Dick from plus random letters.
Oh, that's why there's a lot of Q.
Oh, okay.
Junk DNA.
Yeah. Okay. So that's why. And even if there's no junk, I believe you still will have a finite Q value.
Not that at all.
Very rare.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Okay, so this is the.
Excuse me, why didn't you pick out? I still don't understand. Why didn't you pick out QU? Because
why didn't.
Why did you just not look?
Oh, this is only. No, this is only a finite fraction of the dictionary at step three. I'm only showing you one page. There are lots of stuff down here you don't see. QU is definitely there. QU is definitely somewhere here, okay? So. After we did six iterations, okay, so this is one page of that dictionary ordered by the quality factor. You see, all these words have very high quality factor. And most of these are legal English words. When achieved of no means. No, not highest, but it's just quality factor is highest. Oh, here, Belize. Belize will be turned. Belize.
So what is the average? What does that 12 mean again? It's the average?
The 12, there are total 12 occurrences of this word. And because its quality factor is 1,
yes.
So on average, when you do segmentation, every time you pick it up, right, because that the quality factor is ratio of NW divided by total number of copies.
There's some very strange word on your list.
Because again, this is because of the random stuff in between.
Oh, I see, like bow box.
This is
about bunking.
Where?
Four words from the bottom.
Here?
Four words.
Is this Moby Dick or is it James Joyce's
Okay. The interesting thing is that the algorithm automatically detects the word boundary, right? It does not try to go beyond or or not be, or before. So typically people will say, why don't we just count the frequency of each strand? And in that case, you get lots of redundant stuff. Lots of substrands or bigger strands that contain the word will be.
What fraction of junk letters?
This is about twice as many as the original text.
And the junk letters were not allowed to interrupt words?
No.
Real words.
The words should keep their unit.
Can you say something about the length of the text you have to use in comparison to the number of letters in the alphabet?
I understand your question. So ideally, you want to have, if you have 26 alphabet, and you want to go to a length 4, let's say, right? You need to have 26 up to power 4 size of data, because for each word of length 4, you need to have at least 2 copies of them. So if you just say one thing happened once, you cannot infer anything.
I don't think that it would work if you had, that it depends on the person's dictionary, that if you had very few common words applied for, then you need less data than 26.
Yeah, it certainly depends on the data structure, right? Because I just said in general, how data sets should scale with length, but this is not the case, because you see lots of these words occur only twice, we pick it up. As long as they occurred more than once, we should be able to pick it up.
What is the bracket mean? Everything is a perfect integer, so is there an average?
The bracket is the average over segmentations, because we are considering all possible segmentations. Yeah, because the quality factor is so high. Okay, so.
How do you pick these things out? Even if they occur, so increase like two.
Two, yeah, twice.
How do you pick out?
Even if just two, it's still way above your expectation based on the previous dictionary, right? So you try to piece them together, and you see it's highly unlikely to have it occur twice. So just doing Moby Dick is not good for somebody at medical school. You have trouble getting money from NIH. So we have to do some biology stuff. So
you didn't put the junk in between words. There's nothing like introns and exons.
We did. We did put twice as many junk in between words.
But you didn't break the words themselves.
Oh, right. We did not break the words themselves.
And if you, okay, have you done that?
No, we haven't done that. If you break the words themselves, you cannot recover the original stuff, right? But, yeah.
Some promoter sequences have random components in the middle?
Yes.
So that would be a way of
modeling. There are stuff with random components in the middle. It's very frequently occurred in E. coli genome.
If
the text is long enough, if the text is infinite, right? If maybe you write 10 volumes of Moby Dick, then you tend to get rid of the wrong words that happened by a word concatenated with a random letter because we insert junk there. You see, sometimes you pick up a word that has the word component in it and plus a random junk letter at the end. That event is become less and less likely, I mean, compared to the probability of itself if your data size grow.
So there are two different things. One is that given the size of the alphabet, it would be very difficult, or is it a way of updating the new data? Because I can imagine pruning one of these words in the dictionary, extracting it, and the new data became available.
Mm-hmm. We do have a step that can go back. We have a sub-program that can take a word, grow it by one step on each end, or trim it by one end at each end, and then we put all of them back into dictionary and let them compete.
Words with suffixes and prefixes, is the
Does that not in the dictionary, or?
Words with suffix and prefix?
The dictionary determines word pieces as well.
Yeah, standard pieces like th are still there, right? Th.
Not th, I think more like suffixes and things like that. Things with other functional units.
ING? Yeah. We got ING? Yeah.
And secondly, if you look at the quality factor, does that correlate with where you start getting nonsense?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah? How many mutations? So make the word spell wrong. We haven't done that for the English, but I will talk very briefly about one example we did for DNA sequence. Because, I will talk a little bit about that.
You being the chairman of this session,
yes.
Can I just say we have a tradition of taking a break after.
Okay, so we break?
Well, you are the chairman.
Okay, so let's break for 5 minutes. So, we apply this algorithm to first as a test. We apply the algorithm to a whole chromosome, right? Assuming we know nothing about the structure of the chromosome, we just use this algorithm to build the dictionary up to length 4, so 1, 2, 3, 4.
That will include
both exons and intergenic regions. So, and by the end, we discover the genetic code. But 50 years later, so this is the one of the dictionary. Now this is one page of that dictionary. What?
Chromosome
4 of yeast. Yeah, of yeast. And we see all these triplet codons in the dictionary, and then we see two stop codons, and below that we start to see segment of different lengths, 1, 2, 4, etc. So it's very, with only a prior assumption about data structure.
Could you go back to short of
yeah.
Unfortunately,
GNA is very high.
It's not very, I mean, compared to English, it's not that great.
Yeah,
we use this algorithm to analyze the regulatory regions in each genome. Basically, we just take every open reading frame and go upstream for a few hundred base pair, typically 600 base pair upstream, and cut it off by some coding region, another coding region upstream. So this is the intergenic region.
And you don't weigh anything by proximity to start code?
No. In this algorithm, it will increase the number of parameters by a huge amount if you consider positional dependence. Certainly, in biology, all the exceptions happen, right? In yeast, we did look at the distribution of experimentally determined binding site, and most of them occurred in the region 600 base pair upstream. So it has a peak distribution around like 200 base pair, and mostly distributed in the upstream, about 600 base pair region.
So I think low quality for the
Yeah, you also have singulators, right? You have singulators that account for intergenic region, and there are chances you can, since the codons are only size 3, you can break them up into single pieces with finite probability.
What do you mean you say 6,000 promoters?
6,000, there are about 6,000 genes in the yeast. Here, the promoter, I mean, in a very general sense of non-coding upstream region. Not the usual sense of about 100 base pair proximal promoter region.
So when you get the coding and non-coding region, since all triplet codes are represented in coding regions, it means that if you would try to figure out which ones are the coding regions or which ones are the non-coding regions, you get all coding regions.
It's trivial here, because then we can just look at the segmentation profile to see which region are typically segmented into 3. And yeah, but I did not put a graph here into my PowerPoint. And we do look at the segmentation profile And in the region, you see solid phase of length 3 segmentations that correspond into the coding region.
So what it's picking up then is the relative probability of the front-end elastics
rather than... relative probability.
So you could take the non-coding region and it would oppose for amino acids. I think because every triplet corresponds to some amino acids.
Well, you see lots of stop codons in the non-coding.
So that's what I'm saying is,
Yeah. The codon frequency we got here by this dictionary algorithm correlate very well with the codon frequency where you can count from genes, right? It's correlated very well. So we did this, we built a dictionary for all these 6,000 non-coding regions. And the dictionary size is about 1,200 words. And many of them are non-regulatory elements.
So,
to the coding. In East, there are more codings than junk, probably 2 to 1. Yeah. There are more coding regions. Oh yeah, human will be a lot more difficult, yeah. So this is just one page of that dictionary we construct for the non-coding region. Now you see that it can have various different structures, not just, well, it's very different from coding region, I would say.
East doesn't have
Tata box, but Tata box have lower quality factor because it's more or less like a repeat, right? TATATAT.
Is there some reason why the quality factors are similar or
smaller? Here?
Yeah.
Oh, this is just one page of that dictionary.
Oh, I see. This is ordered
yeah.
by
quality. Yeah, this is ordered by quality factor, and I have lots of stuff here. Okay. From this dictionary, what we found is that there are some examples. These are some examples in the dictionary that we found that are non-regulatory sites. For example, we pick 6 out of 1,000 or so non-regulatory sites that are known to regulate cell cycle in yeast. So we pick about half of them by this whole genome scan. Just take all 600 non-coding regions, run a dictionary, we got them. And we also got lots of regulatory sites that are responsible for general metabolism, like carbon metabolism, glucose metabolism, general nitrogen metabolism.
And the letter N means any codon can be there?
Yeah.
And N sub 11 means that can happen 11 times in a row?
Yes.
So that's like an intron.
Yeah, that's like a very fuzzy region. It's a very fuzzy region in between. So typically, this kind of motif occur when you have something bound as a dimer. You see that this is a palindromic. One piece of protein bound here, one piece bound here, and it doesn't matter what happens in the middle.
And why didn't you get the other 6? You got 6 out of 12.
Oh, another 6. There are lots of reasons we can miss them. I'll tell you general statistics. Okay. This is a general statistics. We take to see what we get in that dictionary we built. We compare the words in our dictionary with the experimentally mapped transcription factor binding site in yeast genome. So somebody did the tedious work of reading literature and input the binding sites and the annotations into a database. So we just take it from them. There are about 440 known sites in yeast. These are all done by experiment where they tell you which region in the yeast genome is the binding site. And we compare that. The criterion is that if we have a word that is completely included in the experimentally mapped site, so typically experiments will tell you a region of 30, 50 base pair region. They cannot do very finely because typically they do that by deletion. And if we say we find a word of length 8, 9, 10, that falls in exactly into that experimental determined region, we call it a positive hit. So by that criterion, we hit 114 of this number of non-experimental sites. And you can ask that, what's the probability by chance you will hit that? Right? You can move the experimentally determined sites around in the genome and see what is the probability by chance you hit. And this is the mean and this is the variance. We did a simulation. And we also compare did a couple of comparisons. Here is that when you scramble the dictionary words in the way that you randomly permute the orders of letters in the word, while still keeping its composition. And this is what you get. You hit this number, and this is the mean, and this is variance. So we are doing this is a control. This is a control experiment. And we also compare to...
Why did you not get 14 to
what?
How are you looking at
the... Oh, I didn't hear you. Can you...
Why? Hmm? So that's only the route, that's only four numbers.
What's the question?
Why did you get so...
Do so well on the Scrabble dictionary? Oh, this is not the world, right? This is like 33.
Why are you doing quite as well on Scrabble dictionary? Still information in there?
Yeah, there are still information, yeah.
Why?
Well, for example, if you have a TATATA motif and you scramble it, it doesn't matter that much, right? I'm keeping composition of the words. I'm still using the same composition of the words.
So in other words, you're scrambling the dictionary rather than...
No. Yeah. We scramble the dictionary rather than the data here.
Okay.
And this is...
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's considerably worse than the true dictionary. What is the
what?
Out of, how many words match this number? This is the total number of experimental sites, and this is the number we hit. And the other side of dictionary, we used less than 300 words.
So you take the top 300
predictions? No, we take the top 500. We take top 500 predictions and we match. I would say that less than one third of the stuff we use. We take roughly top 500 words in the dictionary, and one third of that word matches this number. So there are two thirds new predictions, which doesn't match anything. Did I answer your question?
But that's just like if you pick up a piece of newspaper, there are a lot of words in which
it's not that
page.
No, this is not right. This is like you pick a Webster dictionary and you just pick a small article, and there are lots of words in that article. It's not. Lots of words in the Webster is not in the article. It's the other way around.
Lots of words in the dictionary that's not on the article.
Yeah.
Which is perfectly okay.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Because this is very finite sampling.
Right.
So to do a rough estimate, you will see, let's assume that each gene in each genome will have at least three binding sites. That's a reasonable number. And then you will multiply that by 6,000. You will see there are 18,000 binding sites all over the genome. Yeah, they are redundant, but this number also contains some redundant sites. This also contains some redundant sites.
Non-redundant
means that non-redundant at the genome sequence level, not the motif level. So the redundant, sometimes people did one experiment, they tell you this is the site, and some other people did the experiment, say this is the site. We remove this.
And promoter experimentally is defined that you delete it, and then some protein doesn't come
out. If you delete, the expression changes. There are big effect on expression. Or you mutate it, there's big effect on expression.
What's the overlap between the scramble dictionary, the 33 hits, and the 140
hits?
What's the overlap between those two?
Between these two? I don't remember.
Large overlap, small overlap?
Well, presumably small overlap, because you only get 33, right? And this is 114.
And
so. What?
And for the 33 is also at the top 500
hits? So 33 also, yeah, from the top 500 hit where we scramble the stuff.
So I have a question. If you're scrambling the dictionary, why does the number of expected hits go from 25 to 14?
Because
that number, the number of expected hits, would only depend upon how many trials you have.
No. This depends on what words is in your dictionary. You are trying to find exact match in the genome sequence, right? So if you scramble it, the number of matches will change.
So that's like you look at the first 500 matches.
Yeah, the first 500 words, and we then scramble them. So you get different 500. So you get different hits. false positive is very hard to estimate.
We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know how many of these predictions are true or false. Yes, yes, that's what we are trying to do. We are trying to convince experimenters that UCSF safe to test some of these.
Plasma
of them, is, this is a larger genome-wide study where they just count regular strains in the non-coding sequence that are overrepresented compared to the coding sequence. So this is what they get. This is another, at that time when we published the paper, that's not only genome-wide data available for the non-coding sequence. I would like to just say a few words about comparisons of our Moby Dick dictionary algorithm compared to a number of other popular motif finding algorithms. So Gary Stomo will come here talk about consensus, I hope, and Jun Liu will talk about GIF sampler. And there's another algorithm called MIE. All three algorithms are similar in spirit. They look for motifs by doing local multiple sequence alignment. Instead, here we do segmentation, right? We don't do alignment. And these algorithms typically need to group genes together. They cannot just, you cannot just run GIF sampler on 6,000 promoters. It doesn't make sense. Typically, you need to group genes that are co-expressed, for example, during cell cycle, and then you apply GIF sampler and look for multiple alignment. So these algorithms need to do group genes. We don't need to do that. As I show you, we just run the algorithm on 6,000 promoters. And we can handle very large data set effectively. We can do, typically, we can do tens of millions of base pair sequences, and we can do thousands of motifs together with one dictionary. And we found that we always end up with one unique solution. So once the entries of dictionary is specified, we always end up with the same solution with the same p-value. I still cannot prove it analytically why this is the case. I'm hoping some theoreticians here can help me out and to see why, in this case, the solution is unique. Well, many of these algorithms have local minimums. A lot of times you get trapped in local minimum, you don't find the correct motif.
They're always unique whenever you try it on the same sequence.
What?
They're always unique whenever you try it.
Yeah, for a given data set, for a given dictionary lexicon, you always end up with the same set of solution for the p-value.
Yeah.
Is there some sort of reason why your algorithm is less likely to
get trapped? One reason I'm guessing is that we are doing summation over all possible missing data. That tends to smear the landscape, tends to smooth the landscape a little bit. But I still cannot prove it. And as I will show you, once we start to generalize the dictionary approach to include fuzzy words, the way these algorithms will trade, right? These algorithms will give you alignment, and it tell you a profile for the motif. And we can do that too. But once we start to generalize that, we will see the similar local minimum problem. So I'm hoping the theoreticians here can also help me understand a little better what's going on.
I'm not sure I understand the statement that you are making in the engineering level.
Okay.
What do you observe?
What we observe?
You take a data set.
Take a data set.
Do a procedure and you converge to something.
Yeah.
And then you say this is a exact.
It's unique because we. It doesn't matter which initial condition you start. You always converge to the same point. So you will say, well, since this is the problem with thousands of parameters, right? This is a maximization with thousands of parameters, typically you see multiple minima. And we don't see it here. We don't see it here. We always end up with the same solution.
So am I correct in understanding that the other people, if they start with different set of letters, they would produce different dictionaries?
No, not different set of letters. If they just start with different initial conditions,
then
they will get a different answer.
Different dictionary.
No, they are not constructing dictionary. I will show you what they do. They are trying to get a multiple local sequence alignment. So what I say is that our algorithm has certain advantages, but we also need to generalize the algorithm to handle fuzzy motifs, as we know that biological motifs typically can have lots of mutations. Yeah.
On your deep data, when you scale the 400 or whatever that you missed that were known to lower regions?
300.
300 or whatever. Yeah. Did those tend to be ones that were further down the list, or did they tend to be sort of corruptions?
I would say the reason we miss them on two reasons that I think of. One is that some of these binding sites are not statistically overrepresented in the genome. Right? Protein doesn't care about global statistics. As long as it can recognize the motif, it's fine. So there's no need for protein to have a global statistics. Because our organisms are based on global statistics, so we can miss lots of biological sites which are not overrepresented in the genome. If you were protein, I don't know. If I am protein, if I am protein, I may just want back to one site.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying that it's a big problem.
Yeah. We say there's a general correlation between statistics and function, right? That's what we found, because all the stuff we construct from dictionary are based on statistics, and we show that it's strongly correlated with the functional site. And that's the proof that there is a general correlation between global statistics and function. But in no means it says that it should be always such a correlation. There are lots of cases where this is not true. Yeah, motifs are always fuzzy, but motifs typically tend to have conserved core. Instead of being fuzzy everywhere, it's fuzzy at some point and then more conserved at some other point. So we pick up segments of this conserved core from this algorithm. Sorry? What? Is that what? It's not that conserved. Well, we find lots of motifs in East genome. They are highly conserved. They're very conserved, if you look at the examples.
Conserved means that they also appear
in genome. No. Conserved means that they look similar in different genes.
Oh, in different genes.
Yeah, so same version are used at different places.
Can I ask you a general question?
Sure.
I assume that your strategy is to construct a dictionary using the East genome, but that same dictionary would apply to humans also?
No, it's very different. It's very different.
Very different dictionary. Each organism has a different?
Each organism will have some similarity and lots of differences. If two organisms are very different, such as yeast and worm,
uh-huh.
You expect to see very little conservation between binding sites of similar proteins.
Uh-huh.
Even though the genes are highly conserved?
Even if the genes are highly conserved. The point is that there's a co-evolution. Both transcription factor can change a lot, and the binding site can change a lot. Well, still, the genes can be co-regulated by the same factor in different organisms. But the site will look very different. You find different sites.
For a transcription factor protein to become a binder for a quite different DNA binding site, you only get to change two amino acids.
It's very flexible.
You completely change the specific site.
Yes, there are certainly cases like that, but we don't know how general, how strongly correlate the conservation of transcription factor site, transcription factor with the conservation of the binding site. That we don't have a systematic data for that. Yeah. Right, I already mentioned, the Stomo will be talking about consensus, and Jun Liu will probably talk about GIP sampler, yeah.
Yeah,
all of these are available on the
talk.
The talk, I think. Stomo. Okay, so before I go on, talk about how do we generalize the dictionary approach to include fuzzy motifs, I would like to show you what can you do with the dictionary you get, right? For example, just one example what you can do. Of course, one the most interesting thing is to convince experimentalists to test the sites and see what functional roles they play. But besides that, one can do is that one can use the dictionary to construct similarity mirror between different promoters. The idea is that when you have a protein sequence, you typically do BLAST. You search for similar protein sequences, and then you infer a function. You say, ah, if I find some hits with high similarity, then I believe this protein will have similar function. But here we play a different game. We ask that, can we find the genes that are not functionally similar, but in terms of their gene regulation or gene expression profile, they are controlled in a similar fashion. So to do that, we need to look for the similarities between promoters. But typically, the similarity between promoters are very weak. If you just do sequence alignment, you detect lots of chance alignment. You cannot detect similarity by sequence alignment. So what we do here is that we can use the words we got from the dictionary and construct similarity mirror by asking how likely the two promoters will share a set of words. So typically just a few words occur in each promoters. We ask how likely that they will share similar words in the promoter region. And remember, these words are typically 8, 9, 10 base pair none. So we are talking about very small alignment here. And since we have a dictionary, we already filter out lots of noises. Let's hope that we can use this dictionary to construct a better similarity mirror. So if we use this similarity mirror, we can pull out the genes that are co-regulated in the cell. This is one example where we take one component from the big protein machine called the proteasome. The proteasome is the big machine that digests peptides. And there are maybe about 100 different components of this big machine. They look different on protein level. So what we do here is that we take one component of this machine, we do similarity search through the whole genome, we pull out a whole bunch of other proteins, rank ordered by the similarity mirror. We see that we pick up lots of other components of the same machine, the big machine. And one can rationalize that if it's a big machine, its different components would like to be co-regulated, because otherwise you have free flying parts that are wasted, right? So there's an economic reason for cell to co-regulate different components of the big machine. And similarly, if we do that for ribosomal machines, we get same result. We pull out lots of other components of ribosomal machines. So this is a more interesting example where we try to use one enzyme that is in the methionine synthesizing pathway to see if we can fish out other enzymes that is in the similar pathway. Again, there's a reason that you will see that this whole pathway will act as a module, so therefore there's an economic reason to co-regulate these genes. And if we use this methionine 32, which is one enzyme, we do the similarity search. Again, we pull out lots of other enzymes that are known to regulate methionine synthesis. And we also dig out two other enzymes that on the functional annotation does not say directly related to methionine synthesis, but it has something to do with sulfur metabolism. So this enzyme is a high affinity sulfur permease, and this one has something to do with cysteine synthesis. And we know methionine and cysteine are the two amino acids that have sulfur atom in it. So all this, biologically, all this makes sense.
What is the labeling system for the open reading frame?
Oh, for open reading frame, why? You always start with the Y, so that's yeast.
Yes.
And then from A to P denotes chromosome 1 to 16. And then right R and L means right and left arm of the chromosome.
Okay.
And then the numbers are just consecutive, and with W means Watson strand and C means Quercus strand.
Oh, Watson,
yeah. Okay. It's very systematic. So it's a good annotation system. That's one version of O91C. Probably there are two different versions of 109C. Okay, now I'd like to briefly talk about how we can generalize the segmentation model to include the fuzzy world. So this is one example where the world is pretty fuzzy. You see that at the first position is OA. In the second position, you see 3G, but this one mutated to A, et cetera, et cetera. So if you align them, you get this position frequency matrix that describes quantitatively what are the base pair preference at each position of this motif. So for example, A is 4 at first, then the next base preference is for G, and this is a little preference for G at third position, et cetera. So in general, one wants to quantify this kind of motif by this position frequency matrix. And the Stomer will talk about this, Junior will talk about this. And since they are all trying to find a path that gives you the optimal local alignment, they will also try to derive this position frequency matrix. But what we do, we can do differently by unifying this kind of description into the word dictionary algorithm we have. The idea is that now we can include two different types of word. One is specific, so that SAG is SAG. Another one is fuzzy, right? So we can say M is a word, which is very fuzzy, and we give it the probability PM to denote the average concentration of this motif. And then we need to specify further, right? Once you decide how many times you would like to draw this fuzzy motif, you also have to decide what's the base pair preference within that motif. So now we have a lot more parameters here to describe each motif. But the likelihood function can be calculated very similarly to what we done before. Namely, you want to consider all possible segmentations, and then you count the number of W concrete word that occurred in this segmentation, and then you calculate for a given matrix the number of matrix assignment you decide, right? You decide, because now it's fuzzy, so you can decide, you pick a piece of word, you decide, now I'm going to call this a matrix. And you count the number of this kind of assignment in a specific segmentation, and then you need to count the internal degree of freedom. You ask that with this number of matrix assignment, how many base sigma at position I within a given segmentation? So you multiply this by this factor. So this is a generalization of segmentation algorithm for concrete words.
What is the PM?
What? PM is the probability for the matrix.
How are you determining?
Oh, you determine everything by this self-consistent solution.
I mean, PM is
Yeah, PM tells you the overall concentration of this fuzzy motif. And then F sigma I tells you the base preference within that motif. You can turn parameters smoothly from one. Well, if the data says it's very cloudy, then it's not clear how you can separate them. No, no, it doesn't matter. Once we have a number of matrix, you just consider all possible segmentations.
Let me ask you, do you have this matrix?
Yeah. Then you have to develop a certain similarity measure between matrices. You need to calculate information content of each matrix. So you must have a distance measure between matrices, that's what I want to say. It is a clustering problem, yes, if the motif is very fuzzy, yeah. If you mix two fuzzy motifs that look like each other, yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying we work out every detail of this model, because this, I just put this transparency down yesterday, and we have some new data to show you as of yesterday.
But if that's right,
Yeah, for this algorithm, we implemented, let me first continue, okay. Within this segmentation model, now generalized to matrix, you can derive the similar set of equations for the word and M, etc., similar like what we have before. And you can also derive a set of self-consistent equations for the matrix parameters.
Can I ask a question? Because I just want to understand the difference between words and motifs and fuzzy words.
Uh-huh.
Motif is a fuzzy word. Now, so is a fuzzy word sort of like a word in English that can be spelled differently?
Yes.
By color by American and by Englishman?
Englishman would put it. More what I think is that.
What's the difference between that and mobility? You can consider color
yeah.
and color.
And yeah, I will say, I will consider more typos. When you try to type a word, you put the wrong letter at a given position.
And that would be a fuzzy word.
That would be a fuzzy word.
So fuzzy word is like a mutation?
It's a collection of different versions of mutations.
Different collections.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is the example I show you here, right? So you, for example, this word, if the original word is AAA here, this position is perfectly conserved, and the next one is GGG, but there's a mutation A here. And similarly, lots of mutations can happen in the middle.
So it's more like typos, isn't it?
Yeah, it's more like typos, yeah.
This method also detects short-range correlations between different motifs.
Yes, but the caveat is that you assume fixed gap length, right?
What if you get rid of word plot, just using the matrix?
Well, we would like to use both of them. So because it's in a unified frame, you can implement the algorithm in a unified frame. And sometimes you may just want to use word to cover the nonsense motifs like TA, poly TA stuff. You can just put some word to cover poly TA and hope that the matrix will recover the true motif.
So, what we did previously, each of these versions of the word, I call these typos, the typos imply that there is one correct word.
Well, there's a consensus, for example.
Yes,
there's a
everyone is just correcting the other. So before, if you looked at this, you would consider each of these as a different word, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And now you somehow, by lumping them together, you hope to improve your
exactly. So the if it's very fuzzy, by the concrete word method, you can miss them.
Yeah.
Right? Each version is not significant. But we are trying to put them together in a matrix. So we have implemented this algorithm with words and the fuzzy words. So as of yesterday, this is the recent result. We meet the popular challenge. So what is popular challenge? In the last ISMB meeting last August, the popular proposed the problem. He says, let's take 20 sequences, each 6 base pair long, random at the beginning.
6
base pair long, 20 of them. And then you say, let's implant one motif, which is 15 base pair long, some concrete word, and then you make mutations, 4 mutations for each version. Right. So now you have 20 motifs. They all have 4 mutations out of 15 base. And then he tested various algorithms like MIM, GIPS, and consensus, and he found that most of these algorithms will fail to detect the motif. This is what was discussed in last ISMB meeting. Popular found it didn't work. He has a graph that plots the performance curve as a function of length, and all these 3 algorithms start to fail at a length about 600 base pair. Okay, so we have implemented this algorithm with matrix. We run it on various lengths of this challenge, and we found that even we go up to 2,000 base pair, we can easily identify the motif. And I wasn't able to figure out how to connect my PC to internet last night, so I couldn't give you the solution that we have. But very briefly, we did recover the motif, even if the length is 2,000 base pair long. What I think the advantage with our algorithm here is that since all these 3 algorithms looks for local multiple sequence alignment, there are zillions of passes you have to search through. Not that they fail, not that because the singular is too weak and the statistic is not significant. They fail because they cannot find the correct alignment path. What we do here, we are not looking for any alignment path. since we already sum over all possible segmentations, so in principle, we already sum over all possible paths. That's why I think that's why our algorithm performs better in this example. But there are a number of issues. We do find local minimum in the sense that when you start with different initial conditions, you find different solutions with different free energy, and they look similar somewhat, but they are local minimum. There are multiple solutions corresponding to local minimum, but they all look similar to each other. If you look at the matrix carefully, you find that sometimes you shift the position. So most of these solutions look similar. So what we believe is that now with this algorithm, we have some kind of funnel shape energy landscape. But we don't understand, from analytical point of view, we still don't understand that. So we need help. Try to choose one. In this example, what we take is that we just take four base pair as concrete word, and we take a matrix of length 15. So, namely, we given that we know the length of motif, and it's the same game for all these algorithms. Given that you know the length, there is a length 15 motif. Find it. So we initialize the program with four base plus the length 15 matrix with arbitrary numbers. And we just keep updating this procedure. At the end, we converge to the known motif.
Have you tried with the general method of starting out with one and then two and three
and four? Start from different lengths.
Yeah,
if you didn't know, so we're still working on this. In general, how do you want to construct a matrix? Where do you want to use word? And at what point you want to start to use matrix? There are lots of issues related to this. What do you mean by false positive?
Different conditions. For example, would you observe different false positives?
You get different solutions. Sometimes the solutions are quite different from what you know.
Yes, but I'm.
But then you can't differentiate them by.
According to quality factor, how well does that.
There's still no quality factor here.
No quality factor.
Yet. There's no quality factor yet. Okay, and
so
we just have this metric.
How many?
Well, to give you some idea, let's say we try 20 run with different initial conditions.
Right.
And we end up finding 10 of them look similar to the initial motif you put in. And
the output of your final output is just one single motif.
Yeah, your final output is the p-value for the matrix and the matrix parameters. And from p-value, we know how many copies are there. And from matrix, we know what kind of base preference you put in. No, we can't put multiple matrices, but things will become nasty when you have multiple matrices. Just as Terry said, you can have, let's say you have three motifs and you put two matrices. What are you going to do? You try to do some compromise somehow, because this is maximum likelihood. You always try to get the best description for the data. And in case, if you only have one matrix and two motifs, you'll be doing some compromise, right? It's 12, so I'll take the liberty of being chairman and keep going for another 15 or 20 minutes. No, I'm not speaking this afternoon. I want to finish this. I'm almost done. At the beginning, I mentioned that not only we have the sequence data, we can do statistics. We also have gene expression data. Let's not forget about gene expression data. So what can you do with gene expression data? Here is a very simple example what you can do. The example here is that let's assume that we are analyzing a specific experiment where you have gene expression data. And the simple assumption, a reasonable assumption here is that to say we assume a Wu is responsive in this specific experiment. Because Moby Dick will tell you lots of motifs which may not be responsible for a specific experiment. So here we say, can we use expression data to fish out words that are responsible for a specific experiment? And this is a very simple assumption. We say that if word W is a responsive element, then a gene expression level should in general correlate with the occurrence of this word W. Simple statement. Say, for example, one process is regulated by transcription factor X, then the binding site of X, if a gene has a binding site of X, then on average this gene expression level will be higher. Very simple. So now, with this assumption, we say, so why don't we just do a simple linear fit of motifs to the expression level? And in the linear fit, you say, let's measure the occurrence of W in a gene G and correlate all that with the corresponding gene expression level. We're not paying attention here. And you assume there are a number of relative relevant motifs W here. You sum over all W here. So that's a simple fitting model. And there's a mechanistic interpretation for that model, which is to say that we assume the RNA concentration is mostly determined by transcriptional rate. We forget about the decay or stability for a while. And we assume that the rate limiting step is the polymerase assembly. So there are some energy barriers to overcome when you try to assemble polymerase. And the third assumption is that transcription factor contribute additively to the energetics of this barrier process. You can think about the transcriptional activator as something that can lower the energy barrier for the assembly process. So what we assume here is that the transcription factor contributes additively in terms of energy, which is in general not true. And that translates to a linear model for the expression level, for the log of expression level. Because we are seeing the effect of these factors are additive in energy, therefore multiplicative in rate. And that's the consequence here. So there's an interpretation for that simple formula here. So what we do is that we take a cell cycle data, for example, a data where people do measurement of mRNA level by synchronizing the cell cycle of each cell and then measure at each time point during the cell cycle what's the mRNA expression level for all the genes in the genome. So we use that linear fitting model. We did the iterative fitting. Namely, first we look for the oligonucleotide that correlates strongest with the expression level by calculating the Pearson correlation coefficient and calculate the p-value for it. And then we select that, we subtract the contribution from the fitting for this motif, and we keep going, iterate. And now that from this scheme, you see that we pick up fairly specific motifs. These are the all motifs that have a p-value of fitting less than 1%, 0.01, so with some arbitrary cutoff, 0.01. And in this list, we get 7 of the 12 cell cycle motifs that people know. And more interestingly, this has now become very specific. Right? We are not getting hundreds of thousands of motifs. We only get a dozen or so motifs, and most of them are non-cell cycle regulatory motifs. And this is another example. You can fit the data as a function of time. Then you can plot the fitting coefficient as a function of time. Then you can start to see what role the corresponding regulatory motifs play. This is the data fitting for an experiment where yeast undergoes sporulation. So it changes from one cell in replicate DNA and divide twice. You end up with four spore. So it goes from diploid to a haploid cell. So people, again, synchronize the process and measure mRNA level at different time points. Through that fitting scheme, we discovered two known motifs, MCB and MSE motif, that are known to turn on gene expression. This one turns on gene expression in the middle of sporulation. This one, UIS1, turns on gene expression in the early stage of the sporulation. We also discovered another new motif that people don't know. We also disproved the one motif that people proposed in that paper, where the experimentalists analyzed their data. Okay, but in general, I say that there's a challenge. How do you derive better models to account for quantitative gene expression data? Because we were successful in extracting motifs. And at the end, what we found is that with all these motifs we found, we put them back into a fitting model, we can only account for about 14% of this deviation, of the fluctuation, the expression data. So still, we are missing lots of stuff. And in general, you want to say that, can we find the logic of transcription, which is defined by certain regulatory elements? That will give me a good account for the observed expression level. Of course, the input is the regulatory sequence, right? That's the only variable which is gene-specific. But you cannot say, let's use all the regulatory sequence because it's so specific, it certainly can address uniquely gene expression of each individual gene, but you don't learn anything. So you need to do some projection of the regulatory sequence into a lower dimensional space and say, can you construct a logic circuitry for the observed gene expression data? And I very much hope that we can, series can discuss that, what approach we can use. Where am I going? Okay, just another few minutes. I want to show you one example where the computational approach is combined with experiment and direct new experiment. This is an example. This is collaboration between my lab and Peter Waters' lab at UCSF, where they are interested in studying what happens if proteins in endoplasmic reticulum unfold. The unfolded protein accumulated in ER. What will happen? It will trigger a whole range of response of the cell. For example, the cell would like to upregulate the genes that responsible, the chaperone genes that can fold the protein. And this is what their current understanding of how this thing works. They will say, if you treat the cell by a drug, it will unfold the protein in ER. And that will trigger the activation of a protein called IRG1. This protein will dimerize. And then this protein triggers an alternative splicing process that gives you a correctly spliced form, active form of a transcription factor called HEC1, which is a transcription activator. This transcription activator then will turn on a whole bunch of genes by upregulating the transcription level. But this is the traditional understanding. They have some genes that study in detail, so they know. But now they want to do a genomic study. They use DNA microarray to find out what are the genes that will be upregulated during this process. So by doing DNA microarray experiment, they identified 300 genes that are upregulated during this process. But to account for why these genes are upregulated, they go look for upstream response element, which they found a few examples before. They ask how many of these genes have these non-regulatory elements. What they found is that only 20 of the 300 have the non-regulatory element. So what's going on? There are a bulk of data which cannot be accounted for by the current picture. So either there are other branches of this pathway that turn on a number of different transcription factors that then target different genes, or there are very unknown sites of HEC1 that we still don't recognize. So we have analyzed their data, the 300 genes that upregulated during spoilation or during this unfolded protein response pathway. We get a dictionary with about 150 words. Yeah. And then we ask, what are these motifs that are overrepresented in this 300 gene set compared to the whole genome? By that, we pick up 8 of them which are highly overrepresented. And then we do that gene expression data linear fitting, and we found 4 out of 8 have a strong correlation with the actual gene expression level. So a graduate student, Chris Patil, decided to test these motifs. So he took 8 of those motifs, he put them in triplet, insert that in front of a crippled promoter, which in general do not give you gene expression. The hope is that if this motif is the binding site for transcription activator, then the transcription activator should activate the expression of like Z, which should then you can assess the like Z activity by look at what cell turned blue. And then he insert the whole construction into a plasmid and put them into yeast cell. So this is the biochemistry plot on the functional assay of the motifs. Out of 8 we tested, we see 2 positive. The 2 motifs, so there are a number of assays. You either a high drug or low drug, the deletion of one gene in that pathway, drug and low drug, another deletion, drug and low drug. So this is the traditional response profile of the known upstream regulatory elements. These are the two that we predict which are novel motifs by using that Moby Dick algorithm. So you see that these two motifs have a very similar profile as this one. That indicates the activation of this gene expression is somewhat HIC-1 and IRG1 dependent, but maybe some other transcription factor that need to work together with HIC-1. Currently, what they are doing, they are trying to use the East-1 hybrid experiment to fish out which protein in the East genome binds to this motif. I think pretty much done. Just a summary, there's a big opportunity here, and the number of theoretical approaches can be used to try to decipher the regulatory sequences in the genome. And this is just to acknowledge my collaborators, Sager and Eric Sager, Harman Buschmacher, collaborate with me on that Moby Dick algorithm. With concrete words, Min Zhang from University of Chicago worked with me to generalize the segmentation algorithm to include position weight matrices. And these are the experimenters that collaborate with me at UCSF. Well, thanks.